It's September 1949. We're at the funeral of Jimmy Dunn. The footballing legend and manager of Shamrock Rovers passed away suddenly from a heart attack at just 44 years of age. His family, the club, and its fans are in deep mourning and shock. Sitting in the pews at the church is Dunn's successor, Paddy Code. Paddy had been asked to take the role of player manager at the club, but had been reluctant to do so. However, little did he know that he would become one of the club's greatest ever managers. With an emphasis on young players, Code's Colts would go down as some of the greatest players and teams in League of Ireland history. And welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Ciarán Curwen, along with Gary Spain. Don't forget you can support us on Patreon for just €5 a month, where we put that money back into the podcast to get more ears listening to us. Just go to patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. That's patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. And please share the podcast on your socials and WhatsApp and spread the word about Green Shoots. So let's get down to this week's show. Gary, I suppose in the last podcast, we talked about the things off field, the politics of what was going on in Irish football at the time in the 1950s. And we kind of talked about where that left, I suppose, the name of Ireland between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, etc. I suppose if we move on to the same period, except in the League of Ireland and what was actually happening in the League of Ireland at the time, we kind of left off around about 1952-53-ish, the last time we were talking about the League of Ireland. It's an interesting time around this time as well, the early 50s, isn't it, for Irish football?
Yeah, they were incredible days. I mean, first of all, Irish football was hugely popular in the 50s. There were huge crowds. I suppose, in fairness, there wasn't a lot else going on in the country. You didn't have too many counter-attractions on a Sunday afternoon. But football was the place to be. We kind of finished off, I think, talking about the only All-Cork FAI Cup final in 1953, mm-hmm. when Cork Athletic defeated Evergreen after a replay. Naturally, as we've said, both games were played in Dublin. I'm sure that went down very well in Leaside in 1953, probably as well as it would go down today. But,
the Dubs still trying to make it about them.
Well, it's I think in 1953, it certainly was all about them. In 1953-54 was a pivotal season in the history of a few clubs. Maybe I'll start off with my own and Limerick and our own, because the League of Ireland Shield, which was a one-round competition run before the league, it was hugely important in those days and even included European qualification in the 1960s. But Limerick won a first-ever national trophy in 1953-54 by annexing the Shield and basically pipping Drumcondra and Shamrock Rovers, who were the two big powerhouses in football at the time, just pipping them to the title. So that was a huge day. I mean, I know there was a special train and loads of people found all sorts of ways to Dundalk for the final day. And in true Limerick tradition, we never win things the easy way. We needed to win the Shield, having Drumcondra, I think, had already laid the marker down by winning. Sorry, Rovers had beaten Bowes on the Saturday. And so Limerick had, it was win or bust for Limerick. 2-0 down in Dundalk early on, and 3 goals in 4 second-half minutes turned the game on its head. And Limerick were Shield champions, winning a first national trophy after 16 years in the league. And that was a huge deal. My father was among the hundreds who travelled to the game. It was his first time ever leaving Limerick. Wow. He left on his own, age 14. And it was a huge, I mean, the celebrations went on for a long time, etc. And just a note as well, because he didn't actually play against Dundalk due to injury, but he was a key member of the squad that won the Shield and of the Limerick side at the time. We only lost Patsy Colopy there this year. He was the last surviving member of that squad. Obviously, Patsy was well into his 90s at this stage, but it's a sad loss and one of the famous names of Limerick football in the 50s. But in fairness, and leaving my own bias aside, 1953-54 was a pivotal season for Shamrock Rovers and Paddy Code. And I know many, I suppose, longer in the tooth Rovers fans, and maybe those who have a huge interest in their history, will say that the title in 1953-54 was one of the most important, one of the most iconic in the club's history. And I mean, that's for a club who are well used to winning leagues, well used to winning FAI Cups. But by 1954, Shamrock Rovers hadn't won the league since the 1930s. I think it was 15 seasons. And their iconic player, Paddy Code, I mean, Paddy Code is generally talked about as probably the best League of Ireland player of all time. And he was a Waterford man and he played for Waterford, but his main association was with Shamrock Rovers. And he won every honour with Shamrock Rovers. Apart from, at this stage, he hadn't won the league title. But in 1953-54, he was player manager of a very, very young Shamrock Rovers side. And they were known as Code's Colts. And they were up against, we talked about Evergreen, one of the two Cork sides in the league at the time. It was a nip and tuck title race. It was Shamrock Rovers and Evergreen. It was never much in it. And I think it was Evergreen's last game and Shamrock Rovers still had a game to play. And they were meeting in Milltown effectively to decide the title. If Evergreen won, they were champions. If Rovers won, they were champions. If it was a draw, Rovers had to beat Waterford to force a playoff. It came down to one game in Milltown. There was a huge contingent up from Cork. It said over 700 people made the trip from Cork. Milltown was absolutely packed. And in an iconic game, it actually was a very poor game in the end. There was only one goal in it. And it was a bad a stroke of luck early in the game, a back pass to the goalkeeper, which, of course, was allowed in those days. And unfortunately, the Evergreen goalkeeper slipped as he was coming out to gather the ball. And the ball ran free and the Rovers left winger, I think it was Paddy Ambrose, just tapped it into the empty net. And that was the only goal of the game. That decided the title. And, of course, that Shamrock Rovers team went on to become one of the most iconic and won a lot of trophies running on into the 50s. They were a legendary Rovers team. And but that title win and maybe that slip and that goal was the one that kick-started it all. Of course, their big, bitter Dublin rivals at the time were Drumcondra. Drumcondra won the FAI Cup that year. They were nip and tuck. They traded league titles later in the 50s. But I think 53-54 was an iconic season from that point of view. It's a Limerick winning the Shield, Drumcondra winning the FAI Cup, but in particular, Paddy Code, Code's Colts, winning the 54 League of Ireland title.
And that win, that league title, is that the one that sets the foundation for, I suppose, the through the 50s and perhaps through the 60s as well with the FAI Cup winning teams as well. So is this why it's become this kind of pivotal season for Shamrock Rovers because of this season, this win?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's set up. It's generally considered. I mean, they won FAI Cups after that. Actually, I should point out Shamrock or St. Patrick's Athletic won the next two league titles. In 54-55 and 55-56. But Rovers were runaway winners in 1957. Drumcondra pipped them in 58. Rovers came back and won it in 59. That 57 title win set up famous massive European Cup tie against the Busby Babes, Manchester United, in 1957. So the Shamrock Rovers, the champions of Ireland, were drawn against Manchester United, the champions of England. it came to Daly Mount Park. And of course, the late great Liam Whelan was in that Manchester United team, a cameraman. I'll talk about him for Republic of Ireland as well. But that team, they came to Daly Mount Park and they beat Shamrock Rovers 6-0. It was a lot closer at Old Trafford and it finished 3-2 to Manchester United. And but they were absolutely massive games. And of course, tragically, eight of that team were killed in a plane crash in Munich coming back from a European Cup quarterfinal against Red Star Belgrade.
Right.
And of course, they're immortalized in the history of Manchester United. But also in that first round tie is still talked about with Shamrock Rovers. I know I have a good friend and he's following Shamrock Rovers since 1946 and he's also a Manchester United fan. And his first Shamrock Rovers European home game was that first game against Manchester United.
Wow.
His second game was the return leg in Old Trafford, you know. So and he's still going to follow Shamrock Rovers. He's a member of the club and everything. But it's so much, those games are so iconic. And I think that title win in 1954 set up that team. And I talked about the likes of Paddy Ambrose, you had Danny O'Callaghan, you had Liam Toohey. I'm going to forget some of the great names in that Rovers team. But it was a great team that ran through the 50s into the 60s. As you said, they won six FAI Cups in a row from 1964 to 1969. They went on and they were just pipped to the league title in 1971, beaten by Cork Hibs after a playoff. But they won the league in 1964 as well, which it also proved to be their last league title for quite a while. Mm. But I don't want to jump too far ahead there. But certainly that Shamrock Rovers team of the second half of the 1950s and right into the 1960s were the glitz, the glamour. They were the Manchester United of Irish football. They were the big team. I know people talked about when they came to Limerick, they looked like movie stars. And I mean, our own players were much more ragtag or something like that, because Rovers came down, they had fancy kit bags, they had fancy tracksuits, and they just looked at a different level when they came to town. And no other visiting team were probably the same in those days in the 50s and 60s. But of course, they didn't have it all their own way.
You mentioned they were kind of like the Manchester United of the league at the time. In terms of, was the change in what brought the success almost similar to Manchester United at the time? They started putting their faith in young, very young players, developing them, making sure that not only were they young, but there was the longevity of their skills as well throughout a decade, etc. Where the foundation for winning comes from, is they put their faith in developing young players?
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, yeah, you can take the example of the Manchester United maybe class of 92 or the youth team that became Alex Ferguson's team that went on to dominate English football in the 90s and early noughties. So it was something similar. Paddy Coad, he had Coads. There were a young side, a lot of very good young players coming through at the same time. I mean, as I said, Liam Toohey, etc., were on that team. Paddy Ambrose, many of them went on to receive international honours. Frank O'Neill was coming through later on, etc. There was a lot of famous names in Irish football would have come through that Shamrock Rovers side and went on to dominate. And I mean, I suppose there was a lot of big clubs at the time. Drumcondra, as I said, were trading trophies. St. Patrick's Athletic won two successive league titles. And I know Waterford pushed them all the way in 1955. So there was a lot of competition. There was a lot of great players, great clubs. It was the golden age, I think, of League of Ireland football. There were huge crowds going to the games. A lot of famous names. A lot of clubs can look back and say we had great players in those days. If you talk about the last half of the 50s into the 60s, and a lot of big names in those days.
I wanted to talk to you specifically about another club as well, which was Evergreen United. Now they kind of pop up here and there throughout this decade, etc. But it's often one that we don't ever really hear anything about, because obviously, you know, they've changed and moved on and not existing anymore, etc. But explain to us who Evergreen were, and I suppose where maybe they came from, and what was kind of, where did their success come from?
So I suppose let's take a little bit of context. And there's obviously only one club in Cork at the moment, and in Cork City, which is Cork City. I appreciate Cove Ramblers have been around for over 100 years, but I'm talking specifically in
Cue the angry City. Emails from Cove fans.
Yeah, no, I mean, Cove are a fantastic club, and they broke my heart a couple of weeks ago. But anyway, that's by the by, they are an incredible club with over 100 years of history. But in the city itself, for obviously we've talked before about how many clubs Cork has gone through, but for a period in the 30s, Cork had two clubs, Cork FC and Cork Bohemians were there for a while. But Cork United, playing out of the Mardyke, were the main club in the 40s, and we talked about them already. And in general, you can say, if you trace the lineage, even though they're different clubs, you had the likes of Cork United playing in green and white out of the Mardyke. Cork Athletic, totally different club, also played in green and white out of the Mardyke. Cork Athletic, Cork Hibs, started in 1957, again playing in green and white, initially out of the Mardyke, and then Flower Lodge was bought, and that's another story, by the football people of Cork and held in trust. So Hibs moved to Flower Lodge, and again, they were a team in green and white. But Evergreen United were initially a non-league club. They actually entered the FAI Cup in 1936-37, and they were knocked out in the first round by another non-league club, Longford Town. And that's probably a story for another day, but Longford went on to the semi-finals that year, and they were great cup fighters before joining the league in the 1980s. But Evergreen, they entered the cup again in 1950-51 and drew the mighty Shamrock Rovers, entertained them in Cork, in Turner's Cross, I believe, and they were beaten. So they applied to join the league, and there was a decision made in 1951, in June 1951, in the league meeting to expand the league from 10 clubs to 12. And they admitted St. Patrick's Athletic in Dublin and Evergreen in Cork. And Evergreen were, so a second club, they were to compete with Cork Athletic locally, and they were playing out of Turner's Cross grounds. St. Pat's, incidentally, initially started playing out of Milltown, sharing with Shamrock Rovers, before getting their own ground in Chapel Izzet and later in Chicor. But the Evergreen joined the league in 51. Obviously, they didn't have the impact of St. Pat's, who went on to be champions that season. But they did. They were very competitive. They reached the 1953 FAI Cup final, beaten after a replay by Cork Athletic. They pushed Shamrock Rovers all the way. And they were very much a second team in Cork, and not second best by any means. But they had kind of their own area, the whole area around Turner's Cross. And they remained in the league until 1959. And, well, they were replaced by Cork Celtic. Now, some people say maybe it was just merely a name change. In those days, it's a loss. It's very much a grey area, whether it was a new club, whether it was a name change or anything like that. But they were replaced by Cork Celtic for the 59-60 season, again playing out of Turner's Cross. And, of course, right up into the mid-1970s, Cork had two teams, and in many ways the early 70s were Cork football, in fairness, has had many halcyon days, but let's say there's a lot of people with living memory can talk about the Cork Hibs and the Cork Celtic teams of the early 70s. And they were bitter rivals, but a lot away travel wasn't easy in those days. It wasn't, I mean, going to Dublin for an ordinary league match was a big ordeal. So a lot of people would go and watch Hibs and Flower Lodge on one Sunday, and the next Sunday they'd be in Turner's Cross watching Celtic. So it was a lot more common in those days. I don't know too many people today who might be in Tallaght one Friday night watching Rovers and then watching Bowes and Daly Mount the next Friday.
They're keeping themselves well hidden if they are.
One or two can surprise me, but I think they're probably keeping it quiet enough.
Half and half, Scarves.
Certainly, though. Yeah, but in those days it was reasonably common. So, and even I know people who support Cork City today, and it can be, I suppose, you're supporting a team in green and white, which for Celtic fans would be a bit different and a bit difficult. But then they're playing out of Turner's Cross, which was the home ground of Evergreen and Celtic, whereas Hibs would never have played out of Turner's Cross. So you probably, look, sit here in the league over 40 years now, so maybe all that rivalry and all is long forgotten from the Celtic and Hibs days. It's only those of us longer in the tooth that can remember watching these teams play. But there was certainly a very healthy rivalry in Cork football between Evergreen and Cork Athletic, and later between Cork Celtic and Cork Hibs.
Yeah, and as well, you mentioned as well St. Patrick's Athletic as well, and we kind of touched on it in one of our previous episodes about it's St. Pat's begin to come into more competitive surroundings. They come in, they win the league. You know, they win it three or four times in the 50s as well. So we're seeing a kind of an interesting kind of dynamic develop in Dublin between the teams in Dublin City, aren't we? Teams dominating, but they're kind of dominating each other rather than the rest of the league.
Yeah, so I mean, I should really talk about that St. Pat's team. We talked before about them winning the league in their first season. But in 1954, so they won it in 52. In 54-55, it actually became... now, I know I will maybe start talking about Waterford first, which might be a little bit unfair. But that Waterford side, which ended up winning nothing, were hugely competitive. They banged in loads of goals. They scored 70 league goals that season. They had a striker by the name of Jimmy Gauld who was scoring goals for fun. And they really fell up short. They were beaten in the cup semi-final after a replay. There was a controversial missed penalty which cost Waterford against Drumcondra. They were pipped for the title by St. Pat's. I think they met late in the season and Pat's emerged victorious. So it was, they came so close, but they ended the season with nothing. But Pats won the league in 54-55. They retained the title in 55-56. It was Shamrock Rovers that pushed them all the way the following season. But that would have been three titles in five seasons for St. Pat's at the time. Now, they didn't win it for a long time after that, but they did. They had been in the 54 Cup final as well. They were great cup fighters. They won the cup in 1959. They defeated Waterford after a replay. So they were, let's say, a major force in the 1950s. Obviously, Shamrock Rovers were. Obviously, Drumcondra were as well. And I suppose it would be fair to say that in the second half of the 1950s, it was the Dublin clubs that were mainly dominant at the time. Shamrock Rovers, initially maybe St. Pat's and then Shamrock Rovers and Drumcondra. And I suppose not forgetting Shelburne, who had some good teams in that era as well. And they were to win. They won a couple of FAI Cups in the early 60s and won a league in 1962 as well. But they were they weren't pushing for the titles in the late 50s. They were kind of a mid-table team at that stage.
You mentioned Waterford as well there, and I suppose how good they were at the time, but they probably just couldn't get it over the line in terms of trophies, major trophies. But is it fair to say that just like maybe Shamrock Rovers in that pivotal 53-54 season, that the 1950s begins to set Waterford up for, I suppose, what would be an extraordinary 1960s for them?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It definitely set it up. It was a great Waterford team in the 1950s. I mean, I think there were six Fitzgerald brothers who played League of Ireland, starting with Tom in the 1940s, right through to Jack, Peter, Paul. I mean, many of them received international caps as well. So they were still, so the likes of Peter Fitzgerald was still playing when Waterford won a first League of Ireland title in 1965-66. But if what actually happened with Waterford football was they were hugely competitive in the 1950s, very unfortunate not to win a trophy or two. Paddy Coad actually returned to Waterford from Shamrock Rovers in the early 1960s, and his homecoming was a big deal. But for a couple of years in the early 60s, Waterford were actually a very poor side, and they actually finished rock bottom of the league in 1964-65. Wow. And had to apply for re-election. And famously, I suppose, I don't want to jump too far ahead into the 60s, but Sam Prole, the chairman of Drumcondra, the legendary Prole family who owned Drumcondra and were heavily involved in running the League of Ireland as well for many years. So Sam Prole famously said at the league meeting of 1965, and he was of the league champions then, Drumcondra, that Waterford need to pull their socks up. And the following season, 65-66, Waterford went from bottom to top. And even that league win was a little, well, say it was out of the blue. It was an incredible shock. But they didn't even start the league that well. I think they lost two of their first three games, and they were already falling behind the Shamrock Rovers and the big Dublin clubs. But they went on an incredible winning run that included wins in Dublin against Bows and Rovers, and went on to win the title in 65-66. And a big factor in that actually was the arrival of Johnny Matthews from England, who, of course, became one of the legendary names in Waterford football. But he arrived kind of halfway through that season and made a huge impact. And, of course, that Waterford team, that was their first ever league title. And that Waterford team went on to win six league titles in the following eight seasons.
You mentioned something there as well in terms of the off the field type of thing, in terms of re-election and stuff like that. What was that, and was that something that was done every single season, and how did that work? Was there like a panel that judged whether or not your team could come back for the next season to compete?
Yeah, so back, I mean, right up to the 1980s, we had a one division with no relegation. So as I briefly mentioned, there was 10 teams in the league up to 1951. It went to 12. It went down in the 60s, went up to 14. But at the end of each season, the bottom two clubs had to apply for re-election.
Oh.
So it was up to all the other clubs to either vote them in or, in some cases, vote them out. And in most cases, it was a bit of a formality. It was a bit of an old boys club. And I think if the club was run reasonably well, there was no real impetus to kick anybody out. Obviously, certain clubs were going bust and they were being replaced.
Hmm.
And you might have had clubs waiting in the wings to come in, but generally, once you were in the league, they wouldn't necessarily vote you out. And I think most clubs understood that they would look after their fellow clubs, because the following season it could be them looking for the votes to get re-elected. But that did go on at the league meeting every season, and there were cases when some clubs, I mean, famously, I think Cork Celtic were actually kicked out of the league in 1979. They didn't get re-election, if I remember correctly. I want to be careful to say exactly which clubs were not re-elected and which clubs just resigned before that. But generally, the clubs, the bottom two clubs, were re-elected. But it was always a nervous time, and clubs would struggle and try and avoid the bottom two places. and because it was a bit of a ignominious as well for a club to finish in the bottom two and have to apply for re-election.
100%, yeah. But I would presume that if their, I suppose their finances, etc., were in order, that they were probably generally okay, because, you know, that's the league. You know, once you were financially okay, they probably were like, okay, you can come back. Do you know what I mean? From a kind of stability point of view, maybe.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I do remember actually a point in Limerick's history in the late 1940s, because Limerick had to apply for re-election, and the Sligo Rovers, who we talked about, had been out of the league for a number of years during World War II. And there had been talk that Limerick might be kicked out and Sligo Rovers stepped in their place, because they were ready to come back. But Sligo made it very clear that they would only want to come into the league if they were accepted back, and they wouldn't want anybody kicked out. And they certainly wouldn't want Limerick kicked out, which is was certainly very nice of them at the time. And in fairness, we've always had a very good relationship with Sligo Rovers, notwithstanding some issues with hooliganism between the fans in the 70s. But certainly on the club front, the clubs between Limerick and Sligo, there's always been a good and very friendly and very healthy relationship.
You mentioned the expansion of 10 to 12 teams during the period as well. I'm not sure if you actually know the answer to this, but how did they decide what teams got the license to come and play? Was it they would look at the size of the team, or the gates you were getting, or were your finances good enough? Like, how do you decide on what two teams get to come into a closed off kind of league?
No, there would be no licensing or anything back in those days. So I think a lot of the factors. So I know, let's say, for that 10 to 12 in 1951, so St. Patrick's Athletic and Evergreen would have made proposals. So St. Pat's would have been heavily involved in the latter stages. They reached an FAI Cup semi-final in 1948. They were certainly competitive on the pitch with the league clubs. They had some famous scouts, I think, to beat Shelburne. They were making the case, we've got some good players, our finances are in a strong position, we're ready to come into the league, we've got an agreement with Shamrock Rovers that we can share Milltown if we're elected into the league. So that was their case, and it was made to the other clubs. Evergreen's case was something similar. We have the Turner's Cross ground. They did state, look, it's going to need a lot of work, a lot of improvements are going to need to be made. So, I mean, I was in Turner's Cross in the 1970s following Limerick, and I'd certainly say it was, even into the 80s, there were a lot of improvements. It's certainly unrecognisable from the ground it is today. You were just basically standing on grass banks. So I don't know what it was like in 1951, but they said a lot of improvements would have needed to be made, but they were committed to making those improvements if they were elected into the league. And I'm not aware of any other clubs at that stage, let's say, competing with St. Pat's and competing with Evergreen trying to get in. But so I suppose the other important thing was it was important to keep an even number of clubs in the league. It was stuff like that. If you go back into the 1940s, the likes of St. James's Gate and Brideville were leaving the league. It went down to 8 clubs for a while. Then Sligo Rovers came back. Transport came back. Transport joined the league with Sligo Rovers. I think that's the way it went in the late 40s. So, again, you just had to keep either 8, 10, 12 clubs so everybody would have a game every week.
It's interesting. I ask because we're currently going through perhaps something similar here, because we've got junior teams applying for what essentially will be the third division in Irish football as well. So it's interesting to see the kind of that similarity. And I'd imagine that the same questions would be asked of whoever puts in an application in terms of, you know, why do you think you should be in this league? What are your finances like, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously a much more defined formal process in these days. And I mean, you have to follow the licensing protocols. There's so many things you have to have in place. And even though the standards may be relaxed a little bit for the third tier, I think there will be a lot of... So the requirements now would be certainly several levels above what would have been required in the 1950s and the 1960s. This will actually be the first time we'll have a proper pyramid system in Irish football because, as I said, we had only one league right up until the 1980s. Then we had the Premier Division and the First Division when all those new clubs were admitted in 1985. But so this is going to be a bit of a seismic change again when we have the third tier and all these new clubs as well.
Fascinating stuff, really interesting. I've diverted attention away from the actual football, but that was really interesting. It was great to see how that kind of stuff is kind of played out off the field. But I suppose if we turn to the international side then for now at the time, where are we with Irish football in terms of I suppose the national stage?
So if we go back, I know we talked about the dispute in 1950 over picking the players and in 1954 over the name Ireland. But in the early 1950s, we had talked about the failed attempt to qualify for the 1950 World Cup. In the early 1950s, we did mention some mixed results. We took some heavy hammerings in Spain and Austria, but also pulled off some fantastic home wins over the likes of Germany. And we actually hammered Austria as well in Dublin. Pulled off a famous one-all draw with France in 1952 that I have to mention as a Limerick man because three Limerick players lined out that day. And much has been made recently. I know Gavin Cooney has written in the 42. It's a very depressing, if excellent, and accurate article that Limerick hasn't produced a senior international since 1980, a senior men's player since 1982. And a competitive player since Al Finucane captained Ireland in 1971. But in 1952, the team that drew one all with France had Bud Ahern, Sean Cusick of Limerick, who was playing with Limerick FC at the time, and Johnny Gavin, all Limerick men, all great servants, sons of Limerick football. So three Limerick men lined out. It's the only time the three Limerick-born players have lined out in the starting 11.
Were they playing in Limerick or were they in different teams?
No, so Sean was the only one at Limerick at the time. So Bud was already, Tom Bud Ahern was already at Luton Town at this stage. He had initially played for Limerick in 1937-38 season as a very young man. And Johnny Gavin, who a Janesborough man, had been coming through, played for Limerick in the late 40s. He's also a Norwich City legend. He's currently there and will remain, I imagine, for a long, long time, their all-time leading goal scorer, 132 goals for Norwich City.
Wow.
Also went to Tottenham for a season and banged in a load of goals for Tottenham. But he was happier in Norfolk and he went back to Norfolk and again banged in a few more goals for Norwich. Great player for Limerick FC. Capped, he received a number of caps, scored a couple of goals for Ireland. But maybe Bud Ahern was coming to the end of his career in those days. Johnny was maybe starting out his international career. That was actually Sean Cusick's only cap in that game against France. But of course, he made a huge impact to Limerick football. He also played for the League of Ireland, etc. And Limerick had a few. I mean, Tim Kinnean played against Norway the year before. Billy Hayes had been in goal in 1949. So Limerick were certainly producing a lot of quality senior internationals in the late 1940s into the 1950s. And that's even before we want to talk about the 1960s and the likes of Al Finucane and Kevin Fitzpatrick, etc.
So what's happening to the national side? Where are our results going and how are we playing at a national level?
So as you said, we didn't qualify for anything. Of course, there was only one thing to qualify in those days, which was the FIFA World Cup. So I mentioned that draw with France. We end up drawing France for qualification for the 1954 World Cup. So we ended up in a group with France and Luxembourg. And although we beat Luxembourg home and away, France came to Dublin and won a thrilling game 5-3 in the qualification, and they also beat us in Paris. So they went to Switzerland for the 1954 World Cup, and we missed out. Now, that had been it was actually our first defeats to France, but they would have been hot favourites. I did mention in a previous podcast, we'd gone to Paris in 1937 and pulled off an incredible 2-0 win away to France. It remains the only time we've beaten France away from home. That draw in 1952 was a thrilling game in Dalymount, a great result as well. But unfortunately, we came up short in those two World Cup qualifiers. But even moving on to 1955, Jack Fitzgerald, one of the great Fitzgeralds that played for Waterford, we beat the Dutch. Jack Fitzgerald got the only goal in 1955. We beat them in Dublin. A year later, we went to Rotterdam and beat them 4-1. Oof. Can you imagine an Irish team going to the Netherlands today and winning 4-1?
We'd be looking for World Cups after that.
Yeah, and I mean, and another thing from 1956 to show the type of results we had, I mentioned the late, great Liam Whelan of Manchester United. And this is, I suppose, it tells a lot about Irish football, but I have to mention this game against West Germany in 1956 at Dalymount Park. So the 1954 World Cup we failed to qualify for was won by West Germany. And it's an iconic game, an iconic tournament in German football. They beat the great Hungarian side in the final, having been hammered by them in the group stages. It was a massive shock that they won the World Cup. They came from two goals down to beat Hungary. There are legends. I mean, Fritz Walter was the captain. It was a legendary German team. And even to this day, if you're at a football match in Germany and it's raining, they will say it's Fritz Walter weather. Because in 1954, for the World Cup final, it was raining. And they credit that win thanks to the rain. But that German team that won the 54 World Cup, it was the first ever World Cup as well. So quite a number of them came to Dublin in 1956 to play us in Dalymount Park. And believe it or not, the starting 11, I think, contained 7 League of Ireland players. Wow. To face the world champions in Dalymount Park. Now, it should have only included 6 because Liam Whelan had played for Manchester United on the Saturday and got the boat home to play against Germany. But the selectors or the management at the time decided, well, they'd asked the players not to play on the Saturday, and Liam had played for Manchester United, as you do. I don't know how anyone could have turned that down. And they told him basically where to go. You're not on the team. So Liam went home to Cabra and he walked to Dalymount Park with his brothers and he paid his whatever it was, few pence in on the stiles, and Liam Whelan paid in and stood on the terraces with his brothers to cheer on his international teammates against Germany. Now, I mean, I don't know what that says about anything, the way people were treated, but he watched an incredible 3-0 win that we beat the world champions in Dublin that day. Again, I suppose we've had some very famous wins over the Germans that they seem to get kind of forgotten about in the history of Irish football. Mm. And I'll tell a story myself. I mean, I remember sitting in Gdansk at the Euro 2012, and I went to, after we got knocked out, I went to West Germany, Greece, in Gdansk, got a train up from Warsaw. And I was sitting beside this Polish guy, and it could have been, or that quarterfinal was all set up to be Poland, Germany. And we got chatting, and he said, well, this is my dream, he says. Poland have never beaten Germany. I thought this was going to be the day we were going to beat Germany. Of course, they didn't even qualify. Like ourselves, they got dumped out at the group stage. He says, have Ireland ever beaten Germany? And I said, yeah, of course we have. And I said, 1, 2. And I counted 5 times at the time. And then I wasn't sure. Now, I was actually right. I had got it right, but I wasn't sure. And he's looking at me. You don't know how many times you've beaten Germany, but that's the most important thing in the world. I mean, we had beaten Germany in 1936. We'd beaten them in 51. We beat them in 1956 with that game I was talking about. In 1960, we went to Dusseldorf and beat them 1-0. And the goal scorer was Fionn Fagan. And nobody's ever heard of him. We beat England in 20-odd years later in Stuttgart, and everyone's heard of Ray Houghton. But Fionn Fagan in Dusseldorf, 1960, doesn't exactly trip off the tongue or even Joe Haverty in 1956, etc. That a lot of these incredible wins over a huge footballing nation, as I said, they were world champions in 1956 when they got humbled in Dalymount Park. And we beat them, of course, in 94 in Hanover as well when they were world champions. I suppose a lot of those wins and those results in the 50s get forgotten.
Is it perhaps because we kind of touched on it before in previous podcasts, where when we talk about beating the likes of, we'll say, France or Germany, and etc., bar maybe England or somebody like that, that we know them now as the powerhouses of world football, your Germanys, your Netherlands, you know, we know them to be fantastic footballing teams who constantly churn out these kind of fantastic players as well. But back then, in that time period, they weren't exactly, they were good teams, but they weren't that big kind of powerhouse teams that we know now. And the level, I suppose, the playing field, to pardon the pun, was probably a bit more level than it was, we'll say, 30, 40 years later.
I think it's probably fair to say the playing fields were a bit more level and there wasn't the levels of professionalism. But and because the lack of TV, you didn't see these players. Mm. But I think these were huge games at the time and they were considered huge results. I mean, if you look back, I remember just recently looking back at the newspaper coverage of the 1-1 draw with France. And I mean, there was no bones made about it. It was a great performance. We were playing a major powerhouse of world football against France in 1952. Not that that French team actually won anything, but they were certainly hugely competitive. I think they got to the semi-finals of the 58 World Cup, for example, and they had Just Fontaine, who was the leading goal scorer. Mm. But they would have been a major power. So that German team we beat, I mean, clearly they were world champions, so they were a major power in world football. But I suppose some of it is maybe a little bit insular, because I can go on and talk about the campaign for 1958 World Cup, when, of course, we came up against England, the old enemy. And that is a game that did go down, or games that went down in Irish folklore and are still certainly remembered in many quarters. We did come so close to going to Sweden in 1958.
Well, I mean, you started, so you might as well finish. What happened? I'm intrigued. I'm hooked.
So in the 1958 World Cup, we were drawn in a group with Denmark and England. And we defeated Denmark home and away. They wouldn't be the force the Danes are today. They were still an amateur side. And there was no goal difference in those days. So it was going to come down to the two games against England. They also defeated Denmark home and away. So obviously, if somebody got a win and a draw, they would qualify for the 58 World Cup. If we got a win each, you would need a playoff at a neutral venue. So we were well beaten at Wembley. There was make no bones about it. It was Ireland's first ever game at Wembley against England. It was our first time playing them, of course, since 1949. And they got their revenge. They put five past us at Wembley. But came to Dalymount Park, and a win for Ireland at Dalymount Park would have guaranteed at least a playoff for the World Cup in 58. And it was absolutely mobbed. The attendance was probably estimated something like 50,000. My father was on the terraces that day, but as he says, he didn't see the match because of the crowd. But he was there on the big open terrace up that used to be there. For those who remember Dalymount from the not too distant past, there was a huge open terrace opposite the main stand where a lot of people would have gone. As stand tickets would have been quite difficult to get in those days, but you could pay in on the terrace, or you could just wait for someone to break the gate down and get in for free. So people would have been absolute. That was absolutely mobbed. Alf Ringsted gave Ireland an early lead, and we were much the better team. And with practically the last play of the game, Tom Finney escaped, a great name, obviously, in English football, escaped down the right wing and put a cross over. And a man by the name of John Attio, who's not that well known in English football, he didn't get that many caps, but he headed home an equaliser with the last, almost the last play of the game, to equalise for England. And as Philip Green famously said, the silence could have been heard back at the pillar. It was just Dalymount Park, 50,000 people that had been roaring their heads off, just fell totally silent. And it was just shock, absolutely hearts broken. The 58 World Cup dream was gone. And that was it. It finished 1-1. And I know it was a day that haunted a lot of Irish football fans for many, many years. And I know even myself in Stuttgart in 1988, when another kind of John Attio played for Bristol City, there's a statue to him outside Ashton Gate. He's their all-time leading goal scorer, legendary player. But he wouldn't be a famous name in English football. But another man from the West Country, Mark Hatley, came off the bench in Stuttgart. And my mind did flash back to, but it was before I was born, of course, but I knew the story of John Attio, and I said, surely history and lightning can't strike twice. And he did actually have a header that nearly, that, but thankfully, Packy Bonner, he stopped everything that day, and we were not to be denied in Stuttgart. But unfortunately, John Attio broke Irish hearts in 1957. He didn't do anything wrong apart from scoring against us, but he was one of the original villains in Irish football, maybe up there with Toto Scilacci and many, many more. But
in fairness, we came to love Toto. We really did.
Absolutely. And I mean, he did. I would never paint. I mean, he did it the best for Italy. He was a lovable. He was a god in Italy during that World Cup, and he sadly missed. And he was doing the best for his country. So I don't think how you can. And as John Attio was, I mean, he was there. He sent England to the World Cup, and he didn't get that many caps, but I mean, he got that crucial goal, which denied us. It denied us a playoff in the end, is what we would have got. But who knows what could have happened in a playoff at neutral venue. And another thing about that 58 World Cup in Sweden, actually, because it's the only World Cup where the four home nations all qualified. So England obviously qualified by knocking us out. Scotland qualified from their group. Wales, I think, defeated Israel in the playoff for that World Cup. And Northern Ireland famously knocked out Italy and Portugal to qualify for the 58 World Cup in Sweden. And even though England knocked us out, England and Scotland didn't do too much in the tournament. They got, well, Scotland always went out in the group stages, but England also went out in the group stages.
And sliding.
Wales... Northern Ireland, unfortunately, Scotland have made a lot more World Cups than we have. But Wales got to the quarterfinals, and they were knocked out. They were beaten by 1-0 by a certain Brazil. And a gentleman by the name of Pelé scored his first goal in a World Cup in Gothenburg.
Never heard of him.
To send Brazil into the semi-finals. And they went on to win that World Cup, of course. But Northern Ireland also reached the quarterfinals of that World Cup, and they actually lost to France. But they had famously actually beaten... they were in a group with West Germany, Argentina, and Czechoslovakia, and beat Czechoslovakia in a playoff to actually make the quarterfinals.
So what you're saying is basically everybody else got to go to the party except us.
Except us, yeah. And it nearly was everybody except England. But anyway, that wasn't to be.
All right, fantastic. Well, I think that's probably a nice place to finish it. We've covered a lot of ground there. It was really great. A lot of really interesting stuff. And and going through, I suppose, the majority of the 1950s in League of Ireland as well. So a lot of fascinating stories in there. To Gary, we shall talk next time as we move our way from the late 50s into, I suppose, arguably one of the most fascinating decades of Irish football, the 1960s. Lots to talk about, lots of great teams in there as well. So until next time, thank you very much, Gary.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Don't forget you can support us on Patreon for just €5 a month, where we put that money back into the podcast to get more ears listening to us. Just go to patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. That's patreon.com/greenshootspodcast. Please share the podcast on your socials and WhatsApp and spread the word about the show. Remember to support your local League of Ireland club. It's our heritage, it's our game. Until next week, bye for now.